This is a response to Grant Palmer's sexual allegations against Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Polygamy in Nauvoo by Brian C. Hales and Gregory L. Smith. The abstract reads, Grant H. Palmer, former LDS seminary instructor turned critic, has recently posted an essay, Sexual Allegations Against Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Polygamy in Nauvoo, on MormonThink.com. In it, Palmer isolates 10 interactions between women and Joseph Smith that Palmer alleges were inappropriate and, quote, have at least some plausibility of being true, end quote. In this paper, Palmer's analysis of these 10 interactions is reviewed, revealing how poorly Palmer has represented the historical data by advancing factual inaccuracies, quoting sources without establishing their credibility, ignoring contradictory evidences, and manifesting superficial research techniques that fail to account for at least for the latest scholarship on the topics he is discussing. Other accusations put forth by Palmer are also evaluated for correctness, showing once again his propensity for irresponsible scholarship. Essay. Sometime after 1999, Grant Palmer outlined his views on Joseph Smith and plural marriage up to 1835. More recently, he has expanded that paper and retitled it, quote, Sexual Allegations Against Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Polygamy in Nauvoo, end of title. His newer work contains the same material as his former essay with added observations and allegations. Palmer recently posted an article on Mormon Think, a website that is primarily antagonistic to The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and reportedly submitted it for consideration to a scholarly journal. This essay will examine both the accepted methodology Palmer consistently neglects to employ and the errors in his analysis, which, following scholarly standards, could have been prevented. Weaknesses in Grant Palmer's methodology. Throughout Palmer's essay, several problematic issues can be readily discerned. Number one, factual inaccuracies. For example, on page 8, he speaks of a man, Benjamin F. Winchester. But there is no such person. Church history participants included Benjamin F. Johnson and Benjamin Winchester, but no Benjamin F. Winchester. This might seem a nitpicky criticism, but it is an example of how poorly Palmer's essay has been constructed and edited. It also suggests a reliance on secondary sources rather than a consultation of the original documents. Number two, quoting historical sources without establishing credibility of the documents. Palmer is willing to quote just about any source so long as it conveys the message he desires, whether his source is reliable or is apparently a non-issue. In this, Palmer resembles hardened anti-Mormons or uncritical apologists, both of whom are often willing to quote any persuasive voice if it reinforces their predetermined message. Number three, ignoring contradictory evidences. Palmer is entitled to his opinion of Joseph Smith and plural marriage. However, good scholarship requires authors to consider and address all of the evidence, even those sources that contradict the writer's agenda. Palmer carefully ignores all contradictory evidence, but he does so at the peril of appearing overly biased and agenda-driven. Number four, ignoring the most recent scholarship. In 2013, Greg Coford Books published Brian Hale's 3-volume work, Joseph Smith's Polygamy, History, and Theology. With over 1,500 pages, it aims to either reference or quote every known document dealing with Joseph Smith's polygamy. Palmer references these volumes only once in footnote 34. A single mention of it is in itself not problematic, but in dealing with the individual topics in the essay, Palmer routinely ignores pertinent historical manuscripts that are discussed in those volumes and plainly identified in the bibliography. Thus, Palmer either did not read or understand a work that he cites, or he chose to hide important details from his readers. Even if Hales's conclusions are in error, these new publications contain data which Palmer must address if he wishes to be credible. Joseph Smith's reasons for establishing plural marriage. Palmer begins by asking why Joseph Smith established plural marriage. He acknowledges one reason as part of a restitution of all things, Acts 3:21, which restoration is mentioned in Doctrine and Covenants 132, verses 40 and 45. While Palmer is to be commended for mentioning the revelation three times in his essay, he fails to discuss the primary reason for plural marriage in Joseph Smith's theology. Verse 17 explains the need for all righteous to be sealed to an eternal spouse. Otherwise, they, quote, remain separately and singly without exaltation in their saved condition to all eternity, end quote. Verse 63 likewise says that plural marriage is intended, quote, for their exaltation in the eternal worlds, end quote. Unsurprisingly, Palmer completely ignores this non-sexual dimension of Joseph Smith's theology of plurality, even though it deals with eternity and eternal rewards rather than earthly aspects of plurality. Within Joseph Smith's teachings, there is more emphasis on eternal matters than on sexual drive, to which Palmer directs our attention. Following the traditional fundamentalist today, Palmer writes, Joseph Smith taught no one can reject this covenant, bracket, polygamy, bracket, and then be permitted to enter into my glory, for all must and shall abide the law, or he shall be damned, saith the Lord. Palmer is quoting a portion of D&C 132:19, though the addition of the bracketed word is misleading. Typically, such textual emendations are intended to add clarity to a citation. In this case, however, it is not clear upon what Palmer bases his gloss, save his own opinion, since he provides no documentation to support it. If an emendation is not patently obvious from elsewhere in the source text, the author has a duty to justify this reading or risk distorting the source. Unfortunately, for this reconstruction and his readers, Palmer's bracketed commentary, bracket polygamy bracket, contradicts the first line of the verse, which promises exaltation to a worthy monogamous couple who are sealed by proper authority. Quote, if a man marry a wife, end quote, D&C 132:19, clearly refers to a single worthy man being sealed to a single worthy wife by proper authority, such sealed couples shall pass by the angels and the gods which are set there to their exaltation and glory. 19th century leaders certainly understood that a man may embrace the law of celestial marriage in his heart and not take a second wife and be justified before the Lord. This calls Palmer's interpretations into question. In part one of this review, we will consider Palmer's 10 claims of Joseph Smith's alleged extramarital sexual encounters. In part two, we will examine related claims and historical missteps that Palmer makes as he strives but fails to establish his theses. Part one, 10 claims of alleged sexual encounters. Palmer alleges that Joseph Smith may have confessed to sexual encounters. He selectively quotes Joseph's official account in an effort to reinforce this impression for his readers. Quoting, I was left to all kinds of temptations and mingling with all kinds of society. I frequently fell into many foolish errors and displayed the weakness of youth and corruption of the human nature, which I am sorry to say led me into diverse temptations to the gratification of many appetites offensive in the sight of God. End of quote. Palmer then asks, could the gratification of many appetites refer to sexual encounters with women? Curiously, Palmer quotes Joseph's answer, but hides it in footnote 7. Apparently, after publishing the quotation above, the prophet anticipated allegations like Palmer's, so in December 1842, he dictated an addition that permits no misunderstanding. Quote, in making this confession, no one needs suppose me guilty of any great or malignant sin. A disposition to commit such was never in my nature, but I was guilty of levity and sometimes associated with jovial company and etc., not consistent with a character which ought to have been maintained by one who was called of God as I had been. But this will not seem strange to anyone who recollects my youth and is acquainted with my native cheerly temperament. End of quote. Lest Palmer assume that this addition was a late attempt to cover having revealed too much, we note that Joseph made essentially the same clarification to Oliver Cowdery in 1834. Quote, during this time, as is common to most or all youth, I fell into many vices and follies, but as my accusers are and have been forward to accuse me of being guilty of gross and outrageous violations of the peace and good order of the community, I take the occasion to remark that though I have said above, as is common to most or all youths, I fell into many vices and follies, quote, I have not, neither can it be sustained, in truth, been guilty of wrongdoing or injuring any man or society of men, and those imperfections to which I allude, and for which I have been often to lament, were light, and too often vain mind, exhibiting a foolish and trifling conversation. This being all, and the worst that my accusers can substantiate against my moral character, I wish to add that it is not without a deep feeling of regret that I am thus called upon in answer to my own conscience to fulfill a duty I owe to myself, as well as to the cause of truth, in making this public confession of my former uncircumspect walk and unchaste conversation, and more particularly, as I often acted in violation of those holy precepts which I knew came from God, but as the articles and covenants of this church are plain upon this particular point, I do not deem it important to proceed further. I only add that I do not nor never have pretended to have any other man subject to passion and liable without assisting grace of the Savior to deviate from that path which all men are commanded to walk. End of quote from to Oliver Cowdery. One of the more remarkable statements in Palmer's article is on page 3, saying, quote, it is generally unknown that he, Joseph Smith, was accused of illicit sexual conduct with a number of women from 1827 on until his death in 1844. End of quote. One must ask, if this observation remains generally unknown, is it because there is scant supporting evidence or for some other reason? Palmer discusses 10 allegations that, according to his research, have at least some plausibility of being true. He states, quote, sexual claims made against Joseph Smith's character began only after he was married in January 1827. From January 1827 to 1841, a number of sexual allegations are leveled against Smith, several of which I think contain so little information they are not worth mentioning. This section of the article, he's talking about the following 10 accounts, concentrates on the declarations that have at least some plausibility of being true. End of quote. Surprisingly, Palmer seems unaware, or at least unconcerned, that available contemporaneous evidence does not support his assertion. That is, there is at most one accusation of illicit sexual conduct, which is discussed below. As explored below, this claim was made in an offhanded manner, and it was not echoed by those who could have confirmed it. After one mention, it did not resurface until decades after Joseph's death. We will see that Palmer's other evidences are all likewise problematic and dubious on many accounts, and they were made after Joseph's death. Given that novel religious groups were often charged with sexual deviancy, regardless of their actual conduct, it is astonishing that Joseph Smith was not so accused simply as a matter of course. Had there been any hint of scandal, Joseph's enemies would have pounced upon it. The virtual silence is a telling clue that Joseph was not seen as lecherous by his contemporaries until the doctrine of plural marriage was taught. Number one, the Broome County Trial. Palmer's first declaration of Joseph Smith's sexual impropriety is associated with a trial in South Bainbridge, Broome County, New York. The prophet was arrested on 30 June 1830 and was tried the following day before Judge Joseph Chamberlain. 12 witnesses were called, including Miriam and Rhoda Stowell. The hearing was called because Peter G. Bridgman accused Joseph Smith of trying to dupe Josiah Stowell, Bridgman's uncle, out of his money. No trial records are extant. 12 years later, Joseph recalled the trial and claimed that nothing was found against him. Quote, the young women arrived and were severally examined, touching my character and conduct in general, but particularly as to my behavior towards them, both in public and private, when they both bore such testimony in my favor as left my enemies without pretext on their account. End of quote. His recollection was fully corroborated in 1844 when John S. Reed, His non-Mormon attorney for the case visited Nauvoo. Reed recollected, quote, "Let me say to you that not one blemish nor spot was found against his character. He came from that trial, notwithstanding the mighty efforts that were made to convict him of crime by his vigilant persecutors, with his character unstained by even the appearance of guilt," end of quote. To summarize, Joseph was tried on charges unrelated to immorality, and all accounts state he was not guilty of anything improper. Had sexual liberties been proven or even seemed plausible, contemporary anti-Mormon authors would have surely used that such damning material against Joseph. Nothing in these accounts appears to support illicit sexual conduct. Palmer could speculate about the reason for the girl's testimony and then criticize Joseph based upon his speculations, but this would not be evidence. Number two, Eliza Winters. Palmer's second bit of evidence is an incident that reportedly occurred between October 1825 and June 1829 involving a woman named Eliza Winters. Testimony of the described interaction was not recorded until 1834. Palmer writes, quote, "When Joseph and his wife Emma Hale Smith were living in harmony in 1827 to 1829, Emma's cousin, Levi Lewis, accused him of attempting to seduce Eliza Winters, Emma's close friend. Lewis further said that he was well acquainted with Joseph Smith and Martin Harris and that he had heard them both say that adultery was no crime. Harris said he did not blame Smith for his attempt to seduce Eliza Winters," end of quote. Palmer's presentation of the evidence is curious, if not deceptive. He states Levi Lewis accused him, Joseph Smith, of attempting to seduce Eliza Winters, and then he quotes a longer sentence containing the same quoted words as if they were a separate allegation, when in fact he is just re-quoting the same sentence. The original quotation reads, quote, "Levi Lewis states that he has been acquainted with Joseph Smith and Martin Harris and that he has heard them both say adultery was no crime. Harris said he did not blame Smith for Smith's attempt to seduce Eliza Winters, etc. Mr. Lewis says he knows Smith to be a liar, that he saw Smith intoxicated at three different times while he was composing the Book of Mormon, and also that he has heard Smith, when driving oxen, use language of the greatest profanity. Mr. Lewis also testified he has heard Smith say that he, Smith, was as good as Jesus Christ, that it was as bad to injure him as it was to injure Jesus Christ. With regards to the plates, Smith said God had deceived him, which was the reason Smith did not show them," end of quote. Levi Lewis's affidavit, as quoted in E.D. Howe's Mormonism Unveiled. Now, importantly, Palmer misrepresents the quote. According to the published version, Levi Lewis did not accuse Joseph Smith of direct personal knowledge. He does not provide us with a firsthand allegation. Instead, we read that Lewis was allegedly quoting Martin Harris. Palmer deftly transforms a dubious secondhand or thirdhand account into a firsthand allegation. There is much in this account that should make us doubt its accuracy. First, it seems unlikely that Martin Harris would have remained devoted to Joseph Smith as a missionary in the 1830s if he were aware of such hypocritical and immoral behavior. Joseph taught that sexual immorality was a sin next to murder in the Book of Mormon, Alma 39, verse 5. Second, Eliza Winters never referred to a seduction attempt by Joseph Smith, despite having at least two perfect opportunities to corroborate Lewis's allegation. She failed to do so. The first opportunity occurred in 1833 when Martin Harris accused her of giving birth to a bastard child. That Martin regarded this as a damning accusation makes it even less likely that he would tolerate a dalliance by Joseph, as Levi Lewis claimed. Eliza retaliated by suing Martin in court. Throughout the proceedings, no one, including Eliza herself, mentioned a seduction attempt by Joseph, and the case was ultimately dismissed due to jurisdictional problems. The second opportunity for Eliza to confirm Lewis's charge occurred nearly 50 years later. Newspaperman Frederick G. Mather interviewed the 70-year-old Eliza in Susquehanna County, Pennsylvania, specifically to gather derogatory statements about the prophet from his former acquaintances. In the interview, Mather recorded Eliza saying, Joe Smith never made a convert at Susquehanna, and also that his father-in-law became so incensed by his conduct that he threatened to shoot him if he ever returned, end of quote. Notwithstanding her critical attitude towards Joseph and the church she founded, Eliza did not make any accusation regarding Joseph's personal conduct towards her or her other women. Her failure to incriminate the prophet is puzzling if the Lewis allegation were true. The third reason to doubt Levi Lewis' account is silence from the other sources. Lewis was Emma Hale Smith's cousin, and he provided his affidavit as part of the collection amassed by Dr. Philastus Hurlbut and published by E.D. Hall in the first anti-Mormon book. The following members of Lewis's family also provided affidavits to Hurlbut and Howe: Isaac Hale, Emma's father; Alva Hale, Emma's brother; Nathaniel Lewis, Emma's uncle, a Methodist preacher; and Sophia Lewis, the wife of Levi Lewis. These testators were quick to condemn Joseph for eloping with Emma Smith, but they remained utterly silent on the matter of Joseph's supposed adulterous conduct. They would have been witnesses in the same sense as Levi was. He could only repeat information supposedly gained from a third party. Despite their interest in condemning Joseph, these other family members made no mention of Joseph's alleged conduct, even as a matter of rumor. The fourth reason to doubt Lewis arises from falsehoods or implausibilities in the rest of his testimony. If he perjures himself on these points, then he is even less convincing witness on other matters. We do not have the original affidavit, but the published version includes the following claims. 1. He heard Joseph admit that God had deceived him about the plates, so he did not show them to anyone. 2. He heard Joseph say he was as good as Jesus Christ. It was as bad to injure him as it was to injure Jesus Christ. And 3. He saw Joseph drunk 3 times while writing the Book of Mormon. These claims simply do not hold water. Far from denying that he had shown anyone else the plates, Joseph insisted that he had published testimonies of 11 witnesses in every copy of the Book of Mormon. Levi's honesty is questionable if he can blithely ignore what any Book of Mormon reader can easily discover. A study of Joseph's letters and life from this period makes it difficult to believe that Joseph would insist he was as good as Jesus Christ. Joseph's private letters revealed him to be devout and sincere, almost painfully aware of his dependence upon God. The claim to have seen Joseph drunk during the translation is entertaining. If Joseph were drunk, it would make the production of the Book of Mormon more impressive. The charge sounds like little more than idle gossip designed to bias readers against Joseph as a drunkard. In sum, when all the evidence is examined, this report of attempted seduction appears unconvincing and implausible. Palmer's audience, however, will learn none of these facts. Declaration number 3, Marinda Nancy Johnson. Palmer's third declaration involves Marinda Nancy Johnson in conjunction with her the 1832 tar and feathering of the prophet and Sidney Rigdon. Luke Johnson, who was not present but knew some of the participants, published this account in 1864. Quote, "In the fall of 1832, while Joseph was yet at my father's home, John Johnson's home, a mob of 40 or 50 came to his house. A few entered his room in the middle of the night, and Carnot Mason dragged Joseph out of bed by the hair of his head. He was then seized by as many as could get hold of him and taken about 40 rods from the house, stretched on a board, and tantalized in the most insulting and brutal manner. They tore off the few night clothes that he had on for the purpose of emasculating him, and had Dr. Dennison there to perform the operation. But when the doctor saw the prophet stripped and stretched on a plank, his heart failed him, and he refused to operate. If these events were triggered in part by sexual crimes against Marinda, it is strange that Luke, her brother, was neither incensed by them nor even mentioned them. Concerning Luke Johnson's account, Palmer claims in his paper, quote, Eli Johnson was more specific. He was troubled because Smith and Rigdon were urging his brother, John Johnson, to let them have his property, and was furious because he suspected Joseph of being intimate with his sister. Actually, Marinda was his 16-year-old niece, Nancy Marinda Johnson, and he was screaming for Joseph's castration, Palmer wrote. Palmer's willingness to detail Eli Johnson's feelings is remarkable because there is no known report from Eli. At best, Palmer is extrapolating. At worst, he is mind-reading. It is probable that Palmer's commentary is ultimately based upon a late secondhand reference from Clark Braden, a Church of Christ Disciples minister whose religious debates were reputedly free and economical with the facts. Braden, born in 1831, was not present in Kirtland in the 1830s, but in a debate with RLDS missionary E.L. Kelly 52 years later, he stated, quote, In March 1832, Smith, was stopping at Mr. Johnson's in Hiram, Ohio, and was mobbed. The mob was led by Eli Johnson, who blamed Smith for being too intimate with his sister Miranda, end of quote. Importantly, prior to this 1884 claim by a non-participant, all accounts strongly suggest that the mob members were primarily concerned with attempts to live the law of consecration in 1832. For example, Simon's writer clarified in 1868 that, quote, Rigdon and Smith were not assaulted because of their beliefs. The people of Hiram were liberal about religion and had not been adverse to Mormon teaching, he said afterwards. What infuriated the evildoers were some official documents they found, possibly a copy of a revelation outlining the law of consecration and stewardship, which instructed new converts about the horrid fact that a plot was laid to take their property from them and place it under the control of Smith, end of quote. Rigdon's biographer theorized that Sidney was, in fact, the primary target, since he was attacked first and treated more harshly than Joseph. In addition, Miranda recalled in 1877, quote, I feel like bearing my testimony that during the whole year that Joseph was an inmate of my father's house, I never saw aught in his daily life or conversation to make me doubt his divine mission, end of quote. If sexual impropriety was an issue in 1832, it is strange that even hostile sources made no mention of it until 1884. It does not appear in the historical record prior to that time. Declaration number 4, Vienna Jakes. Palmer continues his list of declarations by presenting the case of Vienna Jakes. Quote, while Vienna Jakes was living in Kirtland in 1833, a Mrs. Alexander quoted Polly Beswick as saying, quote, in a quote, it was commonly reported Joe Smith said he had a revelation to lie with Vienna Jakes, who lived in his family. Polly told me that Emma, Joseph's wife, told her that Joseph would get up in the middle of the night and go to Vienna's bed. Polly said Emma would get out of humor, fret and scold and flounce in the harness. Joe would shut himself up in a room and pray for a revelation. When he came out, he would claim he had received one and state it to her and bring her around all right. End of quoting Alexander and end of quoting Palmer. Research supports that Mrs. Warner Alexander was actually Nancy Maria Smith, daughter of William Smith, who is no relation to Joseph Smith, and Lydia Calkin Smith, born December 1, 1822. She married Justin Alexander on September 4, 1850 in Kirtland, Ohio, making her Mrs. Justin Alexander or Mrs. Nancy Alexander. It is not clear how or when her name was mistranscribed, but other internal references also corroborate Nancy as the author. The historical record shows that Joseph Smith's family lived around Kirtland, Ohio from 1831 to 1838. In 1831, Vienna traveled from her home in Boston, Massachusetts, to Kirtland. There she met the prophet and was baptized. She stayed in Ohio for about 6 weeks and then rejoined her family in Boston and was instrumental in converting many of them. Vienna returned to Kirtland in early 1833 and may have stayed with the Smiths, although we are unaware of any documentation to that effect. On March 8th, the prophet received a revelation telling her to gather to Missouri. It is now DNC 90, verses 28 through 31. She apparently left in June because he addressed a July 2nd letter to her in that state. These two brief periods are the only times during which Vienna and the Smiths lived in the same town. Accordingly, if Nancy Alexander's statement is true, in early 1833, Joseph Smith would have needed to accomplish one of two difficult tasks within 3 or 4 months. He would have needed to confirm Vienna Jake's conversion when she arrived in Kirtland, baptize her, convince her of the doctrine of polygamy, and immediately marry her, although the form of such a union would take is not known, while also convincing Emma to let him have a plural wife share their home. The second alternative is that Joseph succeeded in seducing the new convert and persuading Emma to allow him to conduct a physical relationship with Vienna without a marriage ceremony under their roof. Neither proposal seems likely. As a woman possessing conservative moral values, there is little indication that Emma would have ever approved of her husband having sexual relations outside of marriage. Emma struggled mightily in 1843-44 to accept plural marriage. It seems a frank affair would have been even more difficult for her in 1833. All records from the Kirtland period demonstrate that she did not then believe that God-approved plural marriage had been restored. Accordingly, She would have considered polygamous intimacy as adultery and would not have permitted contact between the two as described by Nancy. Palmer's brief and uncritical reference to Vienna Jakes is another evidence of his willingness to include any potentially negative account, regardless of the narrative's credibility. One gets the impression that he is simply borrowing any critical material from secondary sources without rigorously evaluating it for his readers. Number five is Amiss Hill. Palmer also alleges that Joseph Smith had an inappropriate relationship in Kirtland with a woman called Miss Hill in a letter from William McClellan to Joseph Smith III. In this 1872 letter, McClellan claimed to reveal facts that he had been told by Emma Smith in 1847. Quote, "You will probably remember that I visited your mother and family in 1847 and held a lengthy conversation with her, retired in the mansion house in Nauvoo. I did not ask her to tell, but I told her some stories I had heard, and she told me whether I was properly informed. Dr. F.G. Williams practiced with me in Clay County during the latter part of 1838, and he told me that at your birth, your father committed an act with a Miss Hill, a hired girl. Emma saw him and spoke to him. He desisted, but Mrs. Smith refused to be satisfied. He called in Dr. Williams, Oliver Cowdery, and Sidney Rigdon to reconcile Emma. But she told them, just as the circumstances were placed, he found he was caught. He confessed humbly and begged forgiveness. Emma and all forgave. She told me this story was true. Again, I told her I heard that one night she missed Joseph and Fanny Alger. She went to the barn and saw him and Fanny in the barn together alone. She looked through the crack and saw the transaction. She told me this story too was verily true." End of quote. Predictably, Palmer interprets this letter as recounting two separate stories, one about Joseph Smith's involvement with a Miss Hill, and a second regarding a relationship with Fanny Alger, discussed below. Once again, it suspects he may merely be following the lead of one of his secondary sources. Four observations indicate that McClellan was telling only one story and simply became confused. First, there is no additional evidence that Joseph Smith had a relationship with a woman named Hill at Kirtland or at any time in his life. Richard L. Anderson concurs, saying, quote, "I cannot find a possible Miss Hill in Kirtland, nor is there any verification of the story," end of quote. Second, the first part of the paragraph specifies that Emma saw an interaction between Joseph and a hired girl identified as Miss Hill. In the second half of the paragraph, McClellan states that Emma saw him, Joseph, and Fanny in the barn together. If there were two separate encounters, Emma apparently witnessed them both. McClellan claimed that when Emma learned of the relationship, she refused to be satisfied, requiring immense efforts from Joseph to assuage her distress. That Joseph would thereafter engage in the same behavior with a second lady, only to be caught yet again by Emma, seems less likely. Third, an interview 3 years later between McClellan and anti-Mormon newspaperman J.H. Beadle reports only one relationship. Beadle visited Independence, Missouri in 1835 and reported, quote, "My first call was on Dr. William E. McClellan, whose name you will find in every number of the Old Millennial Star and in many of Smith's revelations. I found the old gentleman in a pleasant quarters. He also informed me of the spot in Kirtland, Ohio, where the first well-authenticated case of polygamy took place, in which Joseph Smith was sealed to a hired girl. The sealing took place in a barn on a haymow and was witnessed by Mrs. Smith through a crack in the door," end of quote. McClellan's 1875 story spoke of only one young lady and one relationship. Specifically, he called her, quote, "a hired girl," end of quote, like Miss Hill in the 1872 letter, who was involved with a prophet in a barn, like Fanny Alger in the 1872 letter. The single interaction was witnessed by Emma. Linda King Newell and Valene Tippetts Avery hypothesize, quote, "perhaps in his old age, William McClellan confused the hired girl Fanny Alger with Fanny Hill of John Cleland's 1749 lewd novel and came up with the hired girl, Miss Hill," end of quote. Fourth, if McClellan had information on more than one alleged sexual impropriety, it is probable he would have shared it in other venues than one confusing reference in his 1872 letter. J.H. Beadle would have been elated to include two allegations of Kirtland's sealings in his published interview with McClellan, especially if both were caught in the act by Emma. In evaluating all the available evidence, it appears that the accounts consistently refer to one affiliation between Joseph Smith and Fanny Alger in Kirtland in the mid-1830s. The minor variations in the documents are not unexpected in light of the inherent limitations of the historical record. Palmer's audience will, on the other hand, learn nothing of this. Number six is Fanny Alger. Consistent with his overall prejudices, Palmer discusses Joseph Smith's first plural marriage as if it was an adulterous relationship. However, in a 1904 letter, Mary Elizabeth Rollins reported, quote, Joseph the seer said God gave him a commandment in 1834 to take other wives besides Emma, end of quote. Joseph soon complied. There is strong evidence that this was the prophet's first plural marriage. According to the only known account of these circumstances, which comes to us secondhand, Joseph did not approach Fanny directly to discuss a polygamous union. Instead, he enlisted the assistance of his friend Levi Hancock, who is distantly related to the family, to Fanny's family, to serve as an intermediary and officiator. Levi's son Mosiah wrote in 1896, quote, Father goes to Father Samuel Alger, his father's brother-in-law, and said, Samuel, the prophet loves your daughter Fanny and wishes her for a wife. What say you? Uncle Sam says, go and talk to the old woman about it. 'Twill be as she says. Father goes to his sister and says, Clarissy, brother Joseph, the prophet of the Most High God, loves Fanny and wishes for her a wife. What say you? She said, go and talk to Fanny. It will be all right with me. Father goes to Fanny and says, Fanny, brother Joseph the prophet loves you and wishes you for a wife. Will you be his wife? I will, Levi, she says. Father takes Fanny to Joseph and says, brother Joseph, I have been successful in my mission. Father gave her to Joseph, repeating the ceremony as Joseph repeated it to him. End of quote. Eliza R. Snow, who was well acquainted with Fanny, also confirmed that a plural marriage occurred when she personally added Fanny's name to an 1886 list of Joseph Smith's plural wives. As discussed above, Emma discovered the relationship and confronted Joseph. In an effort to placate her, Joseph called on Oliver Cowdery. However, Oliver apparently sided with Emma, likely concluding that the relationship did not constitute a valid union despite the performance of a priesthood ceremony. On 21 January 1838, he wrote to his brother Warren of Joseph's, quote, dirty, nasty, filthy scrape, end of quote. The word scrape is overwritten by affair. Whether Oliver authorized the change of wording is unknown. Regarding this first plural marriage, Palmer identifies several problems. Number one, he says, there is no marriage or sealing ceremony or record of the ordinance. Response, here Palmer demonstrates ignorance of the secrecy surrounding plural ceremonies during Joseph Smith's lifetime. A few of his sealings can be documented in records written in the time, usually in coded language. For example, Brigham Young's journal for 6 January 1842 records, quote, I was taken into the lodge. J. Smith was Agnes, end of quote. The second word was probably stands for wed and sealed. However, the vast majority of the prophet's sealings were not documented contemporaneously in any way. As discussed above, Mosiah Hancock provided a secondhand account of the marriage ceremony. Perhaps even more persuasive is a witness of two critics. After she left Joseph and Emma's home, Fanny would stay with the Chauncey Webb family. Webb would later apostatize from the church, and his daughter Anne Eliza Webb would marry Brigham Young, divorce him, and then embark on a career as an anti-Mormon author and lecturer. Yet, even though hostile to the church, both Webb and his daughter referred to Fanny's plural marriages as a sealing. The anachronistic use of the term sealing by the Webbs during the Utah period to describe Kirtland area plural marriage should not be used to imply that Joseph saw his marriage to Fanny as a sealed eternal marriage. It does, however, dispel Palmer's notion that the relationship was a mere dalliance. Eliza Jane also noted that the Alger family, quote, considered it the highest honor to have their daughter adopted into the prophet's family, and her mother has always claimed that she, Fanny, was sealed to Joseph at that time, end of quote. This would be a strange attitude to take if their relationship was nothing but a disgraceful affair. Furthermore, the hostile Webbs had no reason to invent a sealing if they knew Fanny was really a case of adultery. The astonishing thing is that they did not link They did not think to change the story into an affair or seduction, but they probably thought that a polygamous marriage would be scandalous enough for their audience, as it doubtless was. Their critical account, however, is a valuable clue to how Fanny, her family, and Joseph understood the relationship as a legitimate, solemnized marriage. Palmer complaint number two, a witness was not present. Response, while the Mosiah Hancock account does not list a witness besides his father Levi, it also does not declare there were no witnesses. Less than half of the recollections discussing plural marriages prior to the martyrdom list the names of witnesses. Palmer is making an assumption and then criticizing his assumption, not the historical evidence. Hancock is said to have performed the ceremony, so he serves as a witness of the arrangement. It was formally solemnized and not simply an adulterous coupling that Joseph later strove to justify as a marriage after the fact. Palmer's complaint number three, there is no text of a revelation permitting polygamous marriage. Joseph Smith may have talked about polygamy in Kirtland, but there is no evidence that he practiced it until 5 April 1841 at Nauvoo. Response, while Section 132 was not written until 12 July 1843, multiple evidences document that Joseph learned of the correctness of the principle in 1831 and was commanded to establish the practice in 1834. The idea that a revelation had to be written before it could be followed is novel, but inaccurate. The first baptisms for the dead were performed without a written revelation authorizing such ordinances. Palmer complaint number four, the LDS Church believes Joseph Smith received the keys to seal couples for eternity on 3 April 1836, not before. Response, we do not claim the Fanny Alger plural marriage was a sealing. Joseph possessed priesthood authority and that could solemnize marriages. The first such recorded marriage occurred 24 November 1835 when the prophet performed the monogamous wedding ceremony of Lydia Goldthwaite Bailey and Newell Knight. It is common nowadays to think of plural marriage as always tied to the doctrines of sealing and eternal marriage, but the two concepts are separate. The historical evidence has Joseph discussing plural marriage years prior to expressing ideas about sealings. Palmer complaint number five, Alger left the state and quickly rejected counsel by marrying a non-Mormon, something one would not expect from a plural wife. Response, Fanny Alger told Elijah Jane Webb, quote, her reasons for leaving Sister Emma, end quote. And Andrew Jensen's notes record that Emma made such a fuss about Fanny. Palmer is entitled to his opinion, but his supposition of what should be expected of a plural wife who has been thrust out of a home by Emma may or may not be valid. Palmer knows nothing of what counsel she received from Joseph, if any. Palmer piles one speculation upon another here to support his theories. Declaration number seven, Lucinda Harris. Palmer's discussion of Lucinda Harris includes a brief statement from Wilhelm Weil's anti-Mormon work. Weil claims that prior to 1886, Sarah Pratt said, quote, Mrs. Lucinda Pendleton Morgan Harris was a married lady, a very good friend of mine. When Joseph made his dastardly attempt on me, I went to Mrs. Harris to unbosom my grief to her. To my utter astonishment, she said, laughing heartily, quote, in a quote, how foolish you are. I don't see anything so horrible in it. Why, I am his mistress since 4 years, end of quote. Both quotes. Without troubling to evaluate the credibility of either Weil or Sarah Pratt, Palmer's shallow scholarship apparently permitted him to cite a brief statement and then move on. However, as a witness, Sarah Pratt and Weil are known to have made allegations that can be shown to be blatantly false. Both, like Palmer, seem willing to repeat any rumor so long as it undermined Joseph Smith. Concerning Weil's accuracy, non-Mormon writer Thomas Gregg wrote, the statements of his interviews in his book must be taken for what they're worth. While many of them are corroborated elsewhere and in many ways, there are others that need verification and some that are probably exist only in the mind of the narrator, end of quote. Biographer Richard L. Bushman provided this assessment, quote, he, Weil, introduced a lot of hearsay into his account of Joseph. Personally, I found all of the assertions about the prophet's promiscuity pretty feeble. Nothing there was worth contending with, end of quote. Hales has discussed multiple additional problems with the timeline and allegations elsewhere. Declaration number eight, Sarah Pratt. While it may seem unlikely that Grant Palmer's historical documentation methodology could get any worse, it does. He next quotes from John C. Bennett, quoting Sarah Pratt, allegedly quoting Joseph Smith. Quote, The Lord has given you to me as one of my spiritual wives. Brackett by Palmer, somewhat like a concubine or a wife for a night. Brackett. I have the blessings of Jacob granted me as God granted holy men of old, and I have long looked upon you with favor and an earnest desire of connubial bliss. I hope you will not repulse or deny me. End of quote. The dramatics in this alleged conversation appear to be Bennett's elaborations. He refers to spiritual wifery, a term Joseph Smith never used except in derision. The revelation on celestial and plural marriage, dictated by the prophet, now section 132, contains no mention of the word spiritual or wifery. Interestingly, Bennett did not adopt terms like everlasting wifery, celestial wifery, eternal wifery, or spiritual marriage, which is evidence that Joseph's teachings and Bennett's claims were completely unrelated to each other, and it casts significant doubt that Joseph Smith would have ever used the term as Bennett alleged. An additional problem with Sarah's alleged account, as filtered through John C. Bennett, is that the evidence strongly supports that they, Sarah and Bennett, were sexually involved with each other. In August of 1842, non-Mormon J.B. Baxendale signed an affidavit charging, quote, Dr. John C. Bennett with having an illicit intercourse with Mrs. Orson Pratt and some others when the said Bennett replied that she made a first-rate go from personal observations. I should have taken, said Dr. Bennett, and Mrs. Pratt as man and wife, had I not known to the contrary, end of quote. Ebenezer Robinson similarly reported in 1890, quote, in the spring of 1841, Dr. Bennett had a small house built for Elder Orson Pratt's family, Sarah and one male child, and commenced boarding with them. Elder Pratt was absent on a mission to England, end of quote. John D. Lee recalled he, John C. Bennett, became intimate with Orson Pratt's wife while Pratt was on a mission, that he built her a fine frame house and lodged with her and used her as his wife, end of quote. Another Nauvooan recalled that Joseph tried to intervene. Marietta V. Curray Smith related, quote, Orson Pratt then as now, 1858, one of the 12, was sent by Joseph Smith on a mission to England. During his absence, his first, i.e. his lawful wife, Sarah, occupied a house owned by John C. Bennett, a man of some note, and at that time, Quartermaster General of the Nauvoo Legion. Sarah was an educated woman of fine accomplishments and attracted the attention of Prophet Joseph Smith, who called upon her one day and alleged he found John C. Bennett in bed with her. As we lived but across the street from her house, we heard the whole uproar. Sarah ordered the prophet out of the house, and the prophet used obscene language to her, end of quote. Precisely what Joseph and Sarah discussed is not known. However, she later complained that Joseph made an offensive proposal to her. In a meeting of the 12 apostles dated 20 January 1843, Joseph Smith told Orson that Sarah lied about me, saying, I never made the offer which she said I did. In 1845, Orson Pratt was interviewed by Sidney Rigdon. After the interview, Sidney concluded that Orson was literally telling the people that all Smith said about his wife was true. Rigdon added, he has left the character of his wife stained by this degraded condescension that he can never wash out. Pratt is determined to make us believe it by virtually declaring it was true, for if he was wrong when he called Smith a liar, then his wife was guilty of the charges preferred. If he was going to opine on these matters, Grant Palmer should have been aware of this data. And, had he known, he ought to have refrained from including such feeble evidence to support allegations of impropriety between Joseph Smith and Sarah Pratt without making a cogent case, which overcomes the limitations we outlined above. Declaration number 9, Melissa Schindel. Palmer continues to quote John C. Bennett's publication, History of the Saints, by reproducing an affidavit from Melissa Schindel. Quote, in the fall of 1841, she was staying one night with Widow Fuller, who has recently been married to Mr. Warren in the city of Nauvoo, and that Joseph Smith came into the room where she was sleeping about 10 o'clock at night, and after making a few remarks, came to her bedside and asked her if he could have the privilege of sleeping with her. She immediately replied no. He, on the receipt of the above answer, told her it was the will of the Lord that he should have illicit intercourse with her, and that he never proceeded to do anything of that kind without a woman first having the will of the Lord on the subject. The further he told her that if she would consent to let him have such intercourse with her, she could make his house her home, as long as she wished to do so, and that she should never want for anything. It was in his power to assist her, but she would not consent to it. He then told her that if she would let him sleep with her that night, he would give her $5, but she refused all his propositions. He then told her that she must never tell of the propositions to her, for he had all influence in that place, and if he would ruin her character, and she would be under necessity of leaving. He then went to the adjoining bed where Widow Fuller was sleeping, got into bed with her, and laid there until about 1 o'clock, when he got up, bid them good night, and left them, and further this deponent saith not. Melissa Schindel, signed with an X mark. Subscribed and sworn before Justice of the Peace A. Fulkerson on 2nd July, 1842. End of quote. Palmer evidently takes this affidavit at face value, writing that on the 1841 evening, Melissa Schindel was propositioned by Smith and Melissa rejected Joseph Smith's offer. However, the affidavit's credibility is questionable on several grounds. Schindel's illiteracy, indicated by her signing an X, shows that she would have required assistance from other individuals, including potentially John C. Bennett, to compose a document. 2 weeks after the affidavit was published, Melissa Schindel's moral character was questioned in Nauvoo's secular newspaper, The Wasp. Quote, who is Schindel? A harlot, end of quote. Catherine Fuller was tried before the Nauvoo High Council on 25 May, 1842, for immoral activity with John C. Bennett. During her trial, she accused Bennett of also sleeping with Melissa Schindel. D. Michael Quinn lists her, Schindel, as one of Bennett's free love companions. The events described in the affidavit include several details that seem implausible. In 1841 Nauvoo, no man, even Joseph Smith, was likely to be allowed to wander into a room where women were already in bed sleeping at 10 o'clock at night. Schindel's claim that Joseph Smith told her that it was the will of the Lord that he should have illicit intercourse with her depicts him as an adulterous hypocrite, acknowledging from the outset that the relationship would have been illicit. Such a depiction of the prophet contradicts the numerous other public and private evidences that Joseph taught and practiced a different moral standard. It is also implausible that the prophet would offer Schindel to make his house her home if she would acquiesce. It seems clear that Emma, the prophet's legal wife, would not have tolerated such an arrangement at the Nauvoo homestead. The Smiths did not move into the spacious Nauvoo mansion until August of 1843. The offering of money, $5, is also singular. None of Joseph's plural wives reported any promises of material benefits or financial favors to them. Plural wife Lucy Walker recalled Joseph telling her, as he discussed a plural ceiling with her, "I have no flattering words to offer. There is simply too much here that does not add up." Declaration number 10 is Catherine Warren Fuller. In her affidavit, Schindel declared that she refused Joseph Smith's advances and then witnessed sexual relations between him and Catherine Fuller. To support this allegation, Palmer also quotes an affidavit from John C. Bennett. Quote, he, John C. Bennett, has seen Joseph Smith in bed with Mrs. Blank, and that he has seen him in the act of cohabitation with Mrs. Blank and Mrs. Blank, all four of whom he seduced by telling him that the Lord had granted the blessing of Jacob and that there was no sin in it, that he told him that Bates Noble married him to Blank, and that Brigham Young married him to Blank, that he had free access to Mrs. Blank, Mrs. Blank, and Mrs. Blank, and various others. End of quote. Bennett asserted that Joseph Smith was sleeping with 7 married women, and Bennett personally witnessed relations between the prophet and 4 of them. Bennett's affidavit is remarkable for its voyeuristic features. Were Joseph behaving as described, it would be surprising if he allowed any man or woman the level of access Bennett claimed. It is also dubious to claim that the women would have permitted it. Bennett and Palmer's reconstruction make them passive objects or props, not realistic human beings of their time and place. Despite his many claims of being a polygamy confidant of Joseph Smith, an examination of Bennett's writings demonstrates that he learned nothing about eternal marriage from the prophet. In an October 28, 1843 letter written to the Iowa Hawkeye newspaper, Bennett reported that his marrying for eternity is not the spiritual wife doctrine noticed in my expose, The History of the Saints, but is an entirely new doctrine established by special revelation. That is, eternal marriage was an entirely new doctrine to Bennett. Since Joseph never taught plural marriage in Nauvoo without emphasizing its eternal nature, Bennett's admission that he never heard of eternal marriage in Nauvoo is a tacit admission that he never learned of plural marriage either. As discussed above, on 25 May 1842, Catherine Fuller was called before the Nauvoo High Council on charges of unchaste and unvirtuous behavior, not with Joseph Smith, but with John C. Bennett and other men. Quote, the defendant confessed to the charge and gave the names of several others who had been guilty of unlawful intercourse with her, stating that they taught the doctrine that it was right to have free intercourse with women and that the heads of the church also taught and practiced it, which things caused her to be led away thinking it to be right, but becoming convinced that it was not right and learning that the heads of the church did not believe nor practice such things, she was willing to confess her sins and did repent before God for what she had done and desired earnestly that the council would forgive her and covenanted that she would henceforth do so no more. End of quote. In this confession, Catherine directly contradicts Bennett's accusation, acknowledging that the heads of the church, which would have included Joseph Smith, did not believe nor practice what Bennett described as free intercourse. Given that Catherine exposed Bennett and implicated Melissa Schindel in fornication with Bennett, it is perhaps not surprising that Bennett would try to discredit her, though his zeal resulted in less than plausible slander. At least some plausibility. As quoted above, Grant Palmer explained in his introduction, quote, a number of sexual allegations are leveled against Smith, several of which I think contain so little information that they are not worth mentioning, end of quote. Instead, Palmer chose these 10 declarations because he believed they, quote, have at least some plausibility of being true, end of quote. Questions of plausibility can be answered in different ways by observers, usually due to the individual biases they possess. Apparently, these 10 allegations are the most convincing evidences Palmer could identify in his entire historical record in order to support his belief that Joseph Smith, quote, was accused of illicit sexual conduct with a number of women from 1827 on until his death in 1844, end of quote. If so, then the allegations that were not worth mentioning because they were more skimpily documented must have been very dubious indeed. Part 2, Other Historical Claims and Errors. On page 16, Palmer proposes an utterly unlikely interpretation of Joseph Smith's public teaching on 7 November 1841. Quote, if you do not accuse each others, God will not accuse you. End of quote. There is no question that Bennett utilized this seduction line. Margaret Nyman testified that Chauncey Higbee, a follower of Bennett, approached her saying, quote, any respectable female might indulge in sexual intercourse, and there was no sin in it, provided the person so indulging keep the same to herself, for there could be no sin where there is no accuser, end of quote. Palmer extrapolates and claims that by 7 November 1841, this, quote, this philosophy was already being practiced by Joseph Smith and John C. Bennett, end of quote. Unfortunately for Palmer, he provides no evidence to support the tenuous claim that the prophet did so. It seems that if John C. Bennett had known about eternal marriage and celestial sealing, he would have exploited those secret teachings rather than twisting a public statement from the prophet. Palmer also includes Joseph in his net without any documentation. With the exception of Bennett, there are likewise no witnesses that Joseph would ever have tolerated secret sexual liaisons between unmarried individuals. On the contrary, he disciplined such behavior when it came to his attention. Halfway through the article, Palmer summarizes, quote, improper sexual advances relating to the Stowell daughters, Eliza Winters, Miranda Nancy Johnson, Vienna Jakes, Miss Hill, Fanny Alger, Lucinda Harris, Sarah Pratt, Melissa Schindel, and Catherine Fuller Warren were made against the character of Joseph Smith from 1827 to 1841. End of quote. Palmer apparently believes his interpretations regarding these alleged interactions, but our closer look reveals how none of them constitutes a credible report of sexual immorality. Expanding his case with innuendo, Palmer continues, quote, additionally, of the 33 women listed by Todd Compton as being plural wives of Joseph Smith, 12 do not have an officiator, ceremony, or witness to their marriage sealing. Fanny Alger and Mrs. Lucinda Harris, who have already been discussed, fall into this category in the 1830s. Mrs. Sylvia Sessions, Mrs. Elizabeth Durfee, Mrs. Sarah Cleveland, and Widow Delsina Johnson in 1842, and single women Flora N. Woodworth, Sarah and Maria Lawrence, Hannah Ells, Olive Frost, and Nancy Winchester in 1843. Is inadequate record keeping the problem? Or are some of these women, especially the married ones, sexual consent relationships? End of quote. It appears Palmer simply performed a superficial review of these women and then drew his extreme conclusion. If he had dug a little further, he would have learned that documentation exists showing that Levi Hancock performed the marriage of Fanny Alger, Andrew Jensen documented a sealing between the Prophet and Sylvia Sessions, Emma Smith participated in the sealings of Sarah and Maria Lawrence, and valid eternal marriage ceremonies were attested for Olive Frost by Marianne Frost, Elizabeth Davis Durfee by Eliza R. Snow, Sarah Cleveland by John L. Smith, Hannah Ells by William Clayton, Nancy Winchester by Eliza R. Snow, Delsina Johnson by Benjamin F. Johnson, and Flora N. Woodworth by Helen Mark Whitney. The volume of evidence Palmer needed to ignore to arrive at his conclusion is impressive. Joseph Smith's tremendous power over church members. Palmer's version of Joseph Smith's polygamy becomes more entertaining as he asserts, quote, claiming heavenly sealing keys to bind and loose gave Smith tremendous power over church members. He used it as an inducement to persuade at least three and possibly four young females to accept his proposals mid-July 1842 to mid-May 1843. Sarah Ann Whitney, Helen Mar Kimball, Lucy Walker, and perhaps Flora Woodworth, all between the ages of 14 and 17, were persuaded by this approach, end of quote. Specifically, Palmer asserts, quote, Newell K. Whitney, Sarah Ann's father, was promised by Smith to receive eternal life to all your house, both young and old, by having Sarah Ann marry him, end of quote. In fact, Palmer misrepresents the statement, quote, verily, thus saith the Lord unto my servant Newell K. Whitney, the thing which my servant Joseph Smith has made known unto you and your family, and which you have agreed upon, is right in mine eyes, and shall be crowned upon your heads with honor and immortality and eternal life to all your house, both old and young, because of the lineage of my priesthood, saith the Lord. It shall be upon you and upon your children after you from generation to generation by virtue of the holy promise which I now make unto you, saith the Lord. End of quote. Palmer affirms that the thing capable of bringing honor and immortality and eternal life to all your house, both young and old, and upon your children after you from generation to generation, is Joseph's plural marriage to Sarah, which is an incomplete interpretation. He ignores the other factor that plays in Joseph's communication with the Whitneys, the eternal marriage sealing of Newell and Elizabeth Whitney on 21 July 1842. 3 days prior to their sealing, Joseph wrote them urgently, saying, one thing I want to see for you is to get the fullness of the blessing sealed upon your head, end of quote. Joseph praised the Whitneys, for I know the goodness of your hearts and that you will do the will of the Lord when it is made known to you. Plural marriage is thus a token of the Whitneys' willingness to obey God, but their complete commitment and eternal sealing that permits seems to us to be the more likely source of the promised blessing. Helen Mar Kimball arranged for her to be sealed to the prophet. Palmer writes, quote, he, Joseph Smith, told Helen Mar Kimball in front of her father, Heber C. Kimball, that if you will take this step, it will ensure your eternal salvation and exaltation and that of your father's household and all of your kindred, end of quote. Palmer forgets to include Helen's other comment regarding the teaching she heard that day. Quote, Helen said, quote, I confess that I was too young or too foolish to comprehend and appreciate all, end of quote, that Joseph taught. Contemporaneous evidence from more mature family members who were better positioned to comprehend and appreciate the prophet's promises to Helen demonstrate that she did in fact misunderstand the blessings predicated on the sealing. Palmer also misrepresents still another relationship. Quote, Lucy Walker, like the other girls, was told by Smith that by marrying him, that it would prove an everlasting blessing to my father's house, end of quote. A closer look at the entire quotation shows that it is the principle of sealing, not Lucy's specific marriage to Joseph, that would bring the blessings. Quote, he, Joseph Smith, fully explained to me the principle of plural or celestial marriage. He said this principle was again to be restored for the benefit of the human family, that it would prove an everlasting blessing to my father's house and form a chain that could never be broken worlds without end, end of quote. By quoting secondary sources such as Todd Compton, Palmer asserts, quote, a second method Smith used to get females to say yes to his proposals was to send family males on a mission that might or did object to his advances. Smith directly approached young Lucy Walker only after sending her father, John Walker, on a mission. He also sent Horace Whitney on a mission because he felt that Horace was too close to his sister, Sarah Ann, and would oppose the marriage. Smith married Miranda Nancy Johnson Hyde a year before her husband, Orson, an apostle, returned from his mission, end of quote. A closer look reveals that John Walker was sent on a mission to help his health. Lucy recalled, the prophet came to our rescue. He said, if you remain here, Brother Walker, you will soon follow your wife to the grave. You must have a change of scene, a change of climate. My father sought to comfort us by saying 2 years would pass away, then he would then with renewed health, and upon his return, he was told and approved of the marriage. Similarly, Horace Whitney approved of Sarah's sealing upon learning of it after his mission was finished. Two separate sealing dates for Joseph Smith's marriage to Miranda Nancy Johnson are available. Joseph Smith's journal contains a list of plural marriages in the hand of Thomas Bullock. It's found written after the 14 July 1843 entry, quote, April 42, Miranda Johnson to Joseph Smith, end of quote. Well over a year after Orson had left on his mission to Palestine. However, the second sealing date of May of 1843 was written on an affidavit she personally signed. The significance of these two dates is unknown, but as evidence that the prophet would send a woman's family members on missions in order to marry her, these cases are not impressive. If Orson had been sent away so Joseph could marry his wife, why did Joseph wait a year before proceeding? And why does Palmer emphasize the amount of time remaining on Orson's mission instead of the amount of time that had elapsed before the mission? His choice shades the account to Joseph's disadvantage. Palmer writes that Joseph Smith told Zinah Huntington, quote, the angel will slay me with a sword if you don't accept my proposal, end of quote. This entertaining fabrication is not supported by any known account of Joseph Smith's visit with the angel. In fact, Zinah testified that Joseph never spoke to her until the sealing. Zinah explained, quote, my brother Dimmick told me what Joseph had told him regarding plural marriage and reported Joseph did not come until afterwards. I received it from Joseph through my brother Dimmick, end of quote. Importantly, Mary Elizabeth Rollins stated that the angel did not appear with a sword until early February of 1842. This was months after Joseph's sealing to Zinah. So, a claim about a sword to Zinah appears anachronistic. Throughout Palmer's discussion, he seems unaware of Joseph's open condemnation of a plurality of husbands. That is, at no time could a woman have two husbands according to God's laws. In the case of Zinah Huntington, legal wife of Henry Jacobs, and Mary Elizabeth Rollins, legal wife of Adam Leitner, the women chose Joseph over their civil husbands in eternity-only sealings that begin after death. Just when we thought Palmer's documentation could not get any worse, he quotes Joseph H. Jackson. Quote, for example, he, Joseph Smith, asked Joseph Jackson for help in winning over Jane Law in January of 1844, stating that Smith informed me he had been endeavoring for some 2 months to get Mrs. William Law for a spiritual wife. He said that he had used every argument in his power to convince her of the correctness of the doctrine, but could not succeed, end of quote. Joseph H. Jackson published an extraordinary account of his alleged interactions with Joseph Smith, including those with William and Jane Law in 1844. However, the historical record demonstrates that Jackson had few opportunities for private conversations with the prophet. Jackson lied when he introduced himself as a Catholic priest to Joseph on 18 May 1843. 2 days later, William Clayton recorded Joseph's remarking, Jackson appears a fine and noble fellow, but is reduced in circumstances. Apparently, Jackson immediately disappointed the prophet's expectations. Only 3 days later, Joseph told Clayton, quote, Jackson is rotten-hearted, end of quote. This gives the supposed Catholic priest no more than a five-day window without Joseph's distrust. It appears that Joseph Jackson sought to marry Levina Smith, daughter of Hiram Smith, but was rebuffed by both Hiram and Joseph. 1 month before his death, the prophet exclaimed, quote, Jackson has committed murder, robbery, and perjury, and I can prove it by a half a dozen witnesses, end of quote. Given how closely Joseph guarded the secret of plural marriage in Nauvoo, it is extraordinary to claim that he would unveil everything less than a week after meeting Jackson. Palmer seemed to believe that John C. Bennett's claims that if a woman refused a plural proposal, Joseph Smith would ruin her reputation. History records that Joseph was turned down by 7 women. His preferred response was to quietly let the matter rest. No evidence of retaliatory excommunications or other vengeful reactions have been found, although twice he sought to counteract allegations he considered untrue. Benjamin F. Johnson wrote of one rejection, relating that the prophet asked me for my youngest sister, Esther M. I told him she was promised in marriage to my wife's brother. He said, well, let them marry, for it will come out all right. Esther and her future husband were married by Almon Babbitt in Nauvoo on 4 April 1844. In another case, on 15 September 1843, William Clayton recorded an incident regarding Lydia Moon. Quote, he, Joseph Smith, finally asked if I would not give Lydia Moon to him. I said I would, so far as I had anything to do with it. He requested me to talk to her, end of quote. 2 days later, Clayton wrote, quote, I had some talk with Lydia. She seems to receive it kindly, but says she has promised her mother to not marry while her mother lives, and I think she won't, end of quote. Lydia was not sealed to Joseph. Another unsuccessful proposal accused was Sarah Granger Kimball, who was legally married to non-Mormon Hiram Kimball. Quote, early in 1842, Joseph Smith taught me, Sarah Kimball, the principle of marriage for eternity and the doctrine of plural marriage. He said that in teaching this, he realized he jeopardized his life, but God had revealed it to him many years before as a privilege and blessing. Now God had revealed it again and instructed him to teach with commandment, as the church could travel or progress no further without the introduction of this principle. I asked him to teach it to someone else. He looked at me reprovingly and said, will you tell me who to teach it to? God required me to teach it to you and leave with you the responsibility of believing or disbelieving. He said, I will not cease to pray for you, and if you will seek unto God in prayer, you will not be led into temptation. End of quote. After this snub, Sarah Kimball sent Joseph away. His only response was to encourage her to pray and pray for her. Cordelia Morley recounted a similar situation. Quote, in the spring of 44, plural marriage was introduced to me by my parents from Joseph Smith asking their consent and request to me to be his wife. Imagine, if you will, my feelings to be a plural wife, something I had never thought I could ever do. I knew nothing of such religion and could not accept it, neither did I, end of quote. However, Cordelia had second thoughts and was sealed to the prophet vicariously after his death. Rachel Ivins also turned down Joseph Smith, but she was later sealed to him by proxy in the Endowment House in Salt Lake City on November 29, 1855. All 5 of these rejections came and went unknown to most in Nauvoo. According to available records, these women suffered no consequence at Joseph's hand, indirectly or directly, for spurning him. Had the women not personally recounted the events afterwards, knowledge of their proposals would have likely been lost to later generations. However, Joseph Smith's interaction with 2 women, Sarah Pratt and Nancy Rigdon, demonstrate that he would defend himself against claims he considered to be false. Joseph likely proposed plural marriage to Nancy, but she declined. While she did not publicly accuse the prophet, she also did not keep the episode secret. One account claimed that she, like a fool, had to go and blab it. Months later, John C. Bennett broadcast his version of the episode in a letter to the Sangamo Journal. Joseph publicly denied Bennett's account, and within weeks, Nancy denounced Bennett's claims in a statement made through her father, Sidney Rigdon. Joseph likewise publicly refuted Sarah Pratt's accusations. He later confided to Orson, Sarah's husband, that she lied about me. Orson would eventually conclude that Joseph had told the truth. When we review Joseph Smith's actions in the cases of Nancy Rigdon and Sarah Pratt and compare them to his reactions upon being rebuffed by Esther Johnson, Lydia Moon, Sarah Kimball, Cordelia Morley, and Rachel Ivins, the historical data makes it clear that if Nancy and Sarah had kept silent concerning Joseph Smith's discussion of plurality, the public scandals that followed would not would have almost certainly been avoided. Helen Mar Kimball, consummated or unconsummated plural marriage. Without any supporting evidence, Palmer asserts, quote, Helen Mar Kimball thought she had married Smith for eternity only, but soon found out differently. She said Joseph protected her from the attention of young men and that her marriage was more than a ceremony, suggesting that she did have or would have a sexual relationship with Smith. End of quote. In fact, there is no evidence that the sealing between Joseph and Helen was intended to be for eternity only. However, several observations argue that Joseph's sealing to Helen Mar Kimball was never consummated. Heber C. Kimball requested that Joseph be sealed to his daughter, to which Helen agreed. There is no historical data suggesting the prophet initiated or actively sought this plural union. In 1892, depositions seeking to discover if Joseph Smith practiced sexual polygamy were sought for litigation between the RLDS Church and the Church of Christ Temple Lot. Helen Mar Kimball was not called to testify, even though she lived nearby and had written two books defending plural marriage. Instead, three wives who lived further away were summoned and all affirmed sexual relations with the prophet in their plural marriages. The most likely reason for Helen's absence was her inability to offer the required testimony of a sealing with a sexual dimension. While we have no firsthand accounts from the prophet's council on marriages to women in their teens, a pattern which began in Nauvoo and was carried over into Utah is instructive. This protocol taught that polygamous husbands should allow young wives to physically mature before beginning a family with them. Eugene E. Campbell described Brigham's later instructions. To, quote, to one man of Fort Supply, Brigham Young explained, I don't object to your taking sisters named in your letter to wife if they are not too young and their parents and your president and all connected are satisfied, but I do not want children to be married to men before the age where their mothers can generally determine. Writing to another man in Spanish Fork, he said, go ahead and marry them, but leave the children to grow. To Lewis Robinson, head of the church at Fort Bridger, Brigham Young advised, take good women, but let the children grow. Then they will be able to bear children after a few years without injury. Multiply and replenish the earth. Palmer seems obsessed with the fact that some of Joseph Smith's plural marriages included sexual relations. In fact, to multiply and replenish the earth was a lesser reason for the establishment of plural marriage. God explained to the Nephites that he might command plural marriage in order to raise up seed to him, Jacob 2 and 30. Hales has made all known documentation of sexuality in 12 of the plural marriages available in print and online. At present, there is evidence of two or three children fathered by Joseph Smith via plurality. Even if that number were doubled, it would still represent a surprisingly small number of children if sexual relations occurred often. The prophet was virile, having fathered eight children with Emma despite long periods of time apart and challenging schedules. A review of the childbearing chronology of Joseph Smith's wives after his death and their remarriages demonstrates impressive fertility in several of the women. Most of them married within 2 years after the martyrdom and prior to the saints leaving for the West. Three of the women became pregnant within weeks after remarrying. Sarah Ann Whitney, who was sealed to Joseph Smith for 23 months, married Heber C. Kimball on March 17, 1845, and based on the birth date of their first child, became pregnant approximately June 15. She bore Heber seven children between 1846 and 1858. Lucy Walker, who was sealed to the prophet for 14 months, also married Kimball. About 3 months after their 8 February 1845 marriage, she became pregnant. She gave birth to nine of Kimball's children between 1846 and 1864. Melissa Lott, who was sealed to the prophet in September 1843, married Ira Jones Willis on 13 May 1849. Their first child was born 22 April 1850, with conception occurring approximately 30 July 1849, or 11 weeks after the wedding ceremony. Seven Willis children were born between 1850 and 1863. Emily Partridge bore Brigham Young seven offspring between 1845 and 1862. Her sister Eliza married Amasi Lyman, and together they had five children between 1844 and 1860. Several other plural wives, including Louisa Beeman, Martha McBride, and Nancy Winchester, also married and became pregnant. In light of the obvious fertility of many of Joseph Smith's plural wives and Joseph himself with Emma, it seems that either that they either bore him children who are unknown today, or that sexual relations in the marriages did not occur often. Conclusion, unsubstantiated opinions and poor documentation. Grant Palmer is certainly entitled to his opinion of Joseph Smith and plural marriage. However, it is important for observers to discern whether his opinion is based upon documented history or simply his own notions. Palmer is not entitled to pass off his opinions, most poorly grounded and some utterly fanciful, as historical fact. Throughout his paper, Palmer consistently succumbs to a weakness found in similar antagonistic writings. He portrays Joseph Smith as a blatant hypocrite and depicts church members as such gullible dupes that they remain blissfully unaware of what Joseph was up to. In doing so, Palmer enters the realm of historical fiction. To assume that Joseph Smith could have blithely transgressed his own theological teachings without disillusioning followers like Brigham Young, John Taylor, Eliza R. Snow, Zina Huntington, and many others is unrealistic. Joseph spent a good part of his life under intense scrutiny. Most of his closest followers were too perceptive to be bamboozled and too religious to become accomplices in a deliberate deception. Even Fawn Brody admitted, the best evidence of the magnetism of Mormon religion was that it could attract men with the quality of Brigham Young, whose tremendous energy and shrewd intelligence were not easily directed by any influence outside of himself. Our review of Palmer's methodology reveals a reconstruction filled with implausibilities and abysmally poor evidentiary support, which undermines the accuracy of most of his conclusions. There seems to be little doubt that Grant Palmer believes his version of Joseph Smith's polygamy, but there seems to be equally little reason that anyone else should.